Hey, Larry.
Hi, Andy. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Doing fantastic.
Excellent. So, you know, there's all these been all of these allegations coming out lately. Kevin Spacey and Harvey Weinstein and President Trump during the campaign was accused of. Roy Moore. The list just goes on. Of all of these, for the most part, of all the ones that I can think of, it's predominantly white men in positions of power being accused by a female. In some cases, like with Kevin Spacey, it's been young men or older boys are accusing these men of doing something improper. And I think the subject, what we need to cover would be along the lines of why do we have statute of limitations? What is statute of limitations? How does that go against... if something were brought to court, and how do you have something that's a 40-year-old case to be admissible in court in the case of like Roy Moore, or even some of the Trump allegations are pretty old. And so before we get into this, I hopefully carefully prepared a little bit of a statement that says that I want to make it explicitly clear that I am not in favor of anyone using their position to gain favors with another party. We aren't trying to litigate whether the accuser is lying or not. The subject is cover the statute of limitations, which is being eroded in many states. I'm also pretty sure that we're going to come up with a double standard here as well, where perhaps a guy is then being manipulated, being assaulted, and maybe nobody believes him. Anyway, I just want to make sure that I don't want to offend anybody with how we're going to cover this conversation. But from a legal point of view, the defendant has rights as well before he is convicted of a crime. And that, from what it seems, is completely being ignored in all of these allegations. So, with that all said, maybe we should cover some terms up front of perhaps like, what is the definition of the statute of limitations? And Larry, do you have how you would like to cover that term?
Well, Andy, the statute of limitation, just by its very definition, is something that's been established by statute rather than the Constitution. So in the collective wisdom of lawmakers, there have been through the years, which I believe it derived from English common law, that proceedings should have a limitation of how soon and how quickly they should be initiated. And so if you look at most criminal and civil rules of procedure, you'll find out that there's a limitation on initiation of proceedings for many crimes. And in some cases, there are no limitations for murder. Like there's no limitations in most states, but there's some period of limitation where a criminal case can be initiated, and on the civil side as well. So it's merely time limits for how quickly the parties have to initiate their claims and have them adjudicated in court. And if they don't initiate proceedings, when they get beyond those periods, those claims can no longer be brought forward.
But doesn't that, this is an argument that I've heard from, then doesn't the aggressor then get off scot-free and shouldn't that person have to look over their shoulder for the rest of their life for committing that kind of crime?
Well, which kind of act are we talking about?
Well, I know that if we're talking about murder,
a particular act or any act.
I know if we're talking about murder, there is no statute of limitations in most cases. But so someone sexually assaults somebody to some varying degree, I'm sure, you know, if we go to the more extreme cases, there might not be a statute of limitations for the most egregious ones like rape or something. But let's just say let's cover where somebody cups somebody's behind. So someone pats somebody on the ass or grabs somebody's ass. That there would be some sort of time limit for that person before they can say, whew, got off with that one.
Well, the statute of limit in criminal proceedings is typically the severity of the crime will dictate how long the statute period runs. And that's why in the case of a murder, there is frequently no statute of limitations, no time limit. And then you would go down the scale from more serious felonies to less serious felonies into misdemeanors. And the misdemeanor statute of limitations is frequently short because the misdemeanor conviction carries a relatively modest penalty. So a crime that carries a penalty of 1 year maximum would frequently have a statute of limitations of not more than a couple or 3 years. So if that touching behind happened to be a misdemeanor offense in a state that still had statute of limitations on the books, that they might be beyond the prosecution zone after a very short period of time. If it was a more serious felony offense, a more serious sexual offense, there might be a much longer period, or in some cases, no statute of limitations in terms of initiating those proceedings.
Right. But shouldn't the guy committing the offense for the rest of his life have to look over his shoulder, even for something of a moderate degree of offense?
Well, there would be some who would say that, and there'd be a compelling argument on the other side, is that when you think about the reason underlying the statute of limitations, you can't put on a fair trial the more and more time passes, because things that would make the trial fair change. People's memories fail and fade, and people die. So evidence that was collected after the passage of a number of years may have been mishandled or deteriorated, or it may in fact have vanished because of the passage of time. So if you have someone accusing you of something, for example, if they say, well, I worked at this grocery store, and while I was a cashier there, one of the associate managers grabbed my breast and squeezed them. Well, every witness that may have existed that would have been able to offer testimony to rebut that accusation may no longer be available if that's a prosecution that can be mounted 30 years later.
Right. In the case of Roy Moore, these cases are 40 years old.
So that's the difficulty of and that's in the case of eyewitnesses. There's other evidence that would also be more difficult, because reconstructing what happened, the house or the building may have been,
right?
There may be so much that has changed in all those intervening years.
So here's the scenario that I'm like, in the case of Roy Moore, if we want to just kind of just pull it back a little bit, make it more generic. So here you and I are in our mid-age, and someone from 20, 30, 40 years ago accuses us of something. Society right now, with all of these people, is just flat out saying that they are guilty, and it's total character assassination, and careers and lives are being torn apart from these allegations. Again, I'm not trying to say that the allegations aren't true, but these are just allegations. None of these things, as far as I know, have been brought into any level of formal charges, and none of them have certainly gone to any sort of trial to find out whether the person is actually guilty of the things. I'm personally having a really hard time with this.
Roy Moore, for those who may not know, Roy is running for United States Senate in Alabama, an election that's going to be held in just a few days on the 12th of December. And all these accusations have come out. And it seems like there's another one added every few days. We hear of a new one. It's unfortunate, because he's running for an important office to make laws for the entire country. And none of this stuff apparently was brought out in the past. And he's held high elective office several times, been Chief Justice in Alabama, and I don't know what all he's been. So we've got all these allegations that are surfacing. And certainly there could be a political motivation underlying those, or they could be true.
Right.
But the troubling thing is that there's no way to adjudicate these because of the passage of time. It would be hard for him to get a fair trial if he were to be criminally charged because of the passage of time and trying to dig up witnesses from that era. And then on top of that, we've had a change in societal attitudes. And it might have been more permissible in the 1970s for an adult male to be dating someone who was 16, 17 years old. And the evolving standards now, that's frowned upon more than it was in that era. So if you look back on your grandparents' generation and you look at the ages of when they got married and when they were having children, and then you try to apply today's standards, it's really not fair. So there was never a time when it was okay to do things sexually against a person's will. So I'm not saying that. But I think one of the accusations is that he asked for or dated a high school girl when he was an adult. Am I correct on that?
The youngest one that I've heard of is a 14-year-old.
That's the youngest one, but wasn't there a number of
middle teenage, like 16-ish aged girls? And just to give Roy Moore a little bit of credit, I have my own political problems with the guy otherwise, but in all the accusations I've heard with him is when the young lady said, "I'm not comfortable with this, please stop," he stopped and took them home. So perhaps it was inappropriate from the beginning to have the relationship up front, but it doesn't seem that he ever crossed a line of forcing something upon someone against their will.
Well, that's not completely. I saw on NBC Today just a couple of days ago where there was one that was working at a restaurant called Old Hickory House, and she said that he did touch her breast or something without and didn't let her out of the car door, and so but there again, we've got something that happened in a business. Old Hickory House doesn't exist anymore, if it happened at all. Any witness that may have been there in the Old Hickory House that would be able to testify would be difficult, if almost impossible, to find. And so we've got the word of an accuser who, for whatever reasons, hasn't said anything for decades.
Right.
And I know that it's difficult for a teenager or a child or a teenager to feel the confidence in that era, because we have to roll ourselves back to where we were in that time frame. And having grown up in the foster care system, I remember how difficult it was to say something about an adult and expect to be believed. So I can imagine the difficulty of saying something about Roy Moore as a teenager, but decades and decades and decades later, when he's at the pinnacle of his career, and as you've said, you have your political problems, I have my political problems with him. I could not imagine myself voting for him, not because of anything to do with this, but because my politics are diametrically in opposition to Roy Moore.
Same.
I can't think of much where I could come to an agreement on him, but I am a due process person.
Right.
And I believe that if these accusations are being made in the final days of a campaign for a very high office that he's seeking, it certainly would raise questions about what's underlying the motivations for these. And the victims' advocates would say that no, that's just simply because it's no coincidence. It just happens. I'm troubled that these accusations are coming out at this time.
Yeah, so it's all the liberal do-gooders are trying to bring down a Republican candidate.
It certainly could have the there could be some of the opposition behind these accusations, and there could be some truth. And then another thing about accusations is that as memories go, we all tend to remember something. If you could get your family together and you could ask them about an event that happened 20 years ago, I will assure you that very few of you will remember that event the same. And you ought to just do an experiment on that. Pick an event where you had 3-4 family members and ask people what happened at that event and key on something specifically. I remember I took a trip to San Antonio when I was in foster care. There was a death in the foster family, and there was no way for us to be cared for. So they flew us out to San Antonio. And my sister and all have a complete different recollection of some of the events at that trip to San Antonio. And we were both together.
And do you think that over the years, as the two of you have talked about that issue, do you think the two of you molded the other's memory and also molded your own as you would go back through the events?
It is possible that we have influenced one another to try to remember something differently. I remember there was a missing watch that I didn't pay a whole lot of attention to that came up missing. And as we talk about it later, my sister says that I was the prime suspect, and I didn't have a clue I was the prime suspect because I knew I didn't have the watch.
So
I didn't think any more about it. I just answered the question, said, no, I haven't seen it. And lo and behold, before the trip was over, it turned up in my luggage.
Wow. Larry,
and
you're,
I still
you're
didn't,
a klepto.
I still didn't have any recollection of it, but the belief was by my sister, who was older, that I got set up.
That sounds legit. So the reason why I bring that up about the memory piece is a handful of years ago, maybe 4 years ago, there was an article, I want to say it was in Wired magazine, and they were talking about PTSD and that there would be a pill that you could take. And while taking this pill, you know, you're under the care of a doctor, possibly like a psychologist, psychiatrist, and this is related to people coming back from the Iraq war and so forth. And they would have you remember the traumatic event while you're taking this pill, so while the drug is in your system, and then that drug would then prevent the memory from going back into your memory banks, thus forgetting the traumatic situation or lessening its impact. Maybe it gets stored in other areas of the brain. But it was a way to forget, which probably isn't the right word, but if you have someone that has severe post-traumatic stress disorder and they're having these really horrible events, what I'm ultimately bringing up is that there are ways of modifying your memory. And in the course of reading the article, every time you remember something, you are pulling that memory off of the shelf and you are then reconstructing the memory in like real time in your conscious brain. And you may forget to pull a detail out. You may add a detail of some other event that you have on your brain at the moment, and then you'll put that thing back on the shelf. So perhaps you remember the blue car as being red, or the person that's 6 feet tall, maybe they're really only 5'5". You're going to alter the events and you'll put them back on the shelf. Next time you pull it back off to remember it again, you remember the new details now, which I think we could then go to bringing up that. Is it true? I'm close to right on this, that you can't just use witness testimony to convict somebody of a crime anymore.
I don't know that I can agree with you on that. That's not true. The witness testimony is certainly it's sufficient to convict someone of a crime. There's not always forensics or independent corroboration of the crime. But in the area of sexual offenses, it's more often that a person will be convicted without that. And the reason for that is without corroboration evidence. That is, with sexual offenses, lawmakers have inserted statutory language to make certain that the juries get instruction that there does not need to be any corroborating evidence. And if the juries were not receiving those instructions, juries typically are more demanding of affirmative evidence when they're trying some other type of charge than a sexual offense, because of just they're watching CSI and the things on television that they watch. They're expecting evidence and they're demanding evidence. But in the case of a sexual offense, the statutes have been crafted in a way that they don't get to demand that evidence because they're instructed that the corroboration of that they don't need the corroboration, but that they can convict based on the accusation, the word of the accusing person, the alleged victim, is all that's necessary. So, he said, she said. It's unfortunate, but that's what we're
just totally from he said, she said. Somebody can go to prison for just a he said, she said.
Yes, and what that does is it causes the attorneys to give advice in those cases that they look at the accuser and how credible that accusing person may come across. What you're doing when you're evaluating the viability of potentially going to trial is this witness believable? And so you look at the totality of that witness and what they're likely to perform, what their performance is likely to be on the witness stand. In some states, you get a better chance to do that because you can have pretrial interviews. In some states, there's no such process. In the federal system, there's no such process, so you wouldn't get the opportunity to compel a pretrial interview. But defense attorneys are looking at that, and then they're looking at the likely makeup of the jury pool and what the jurors are likely to do in that jurisdiction. So as you look around the country from state to state and county to county, we have various levels of education and sophistication among people, and you have jurors that are going to be very deferential to law enforcement and to what they've heard from the cops, because they believe in their police forces and are likely to convict. So you get into a situation where a defense attorney will advise the person, well, that's all they've got is her word, but I'm telling you, they're going to believe her.
Right.
Or
right.
Him. Yeah. It's more likely her, but they're going to believe her. And then the person has buyer's remorse after they take the plea, because yep. They took the plea being told that if they took this to trial, that they were going to get slammed because the jury is going to convict them of all seven of the counts versus the one count that they were offered to plead to.
Yeah.
And that the judge was going to stack the consecutively on each of the seven counts. So rather than getting 3 years in prison, they were going to get 21 years, three on each count. And so they find themselves where they have to choose between a bad option and a potentially much worse option,
mm-hmm.
because there is no requirement that there be corroborating evidence in sex offense prosecutions. It's frequently all they need is the accusing statement. And then we get into a whole other topic for a show, for a podcast, would be about the confrontation clause and aggressive cross-examination. That's something that's missing in these cases, because that's mm-hmm. supposedly attacking the victim and re-victimizing the victim. So defense attorneys find themselves very constrained in terms of how aggressive they can be in cross-examination. If you make an accusation that an employee embezzled from you, you get to run the full gamut on the defense side of saying, well, do you have any other motivations? Do you get to explore motivations for making that accusation against that employee? But in a sex offense, you don't get to do that, because that's re-victimization.
And before we get too far deep into the weeds on all of this, I did some research to find some terms and definitions so that we're kind of working on a level playing field. So one of them was about sexual harassment. And the Equal Opportunity Commission has said that sexual harassment is an unwelcome sexual advance. Is unwelcome sexual advances, requests for sexual favors, or other verbal and physical conduct of a sexual nature that explicitly or implicitly affect an individual's employment, unreasonably interferes with an individual's work performance, or creates an intimidating, hostile, or offensive work environment. Larry, there are all kinds of situations that could be, rabble-rousing behind the guys in the military, where they're making, you have an incredibly stressful situation of combat or, something of that nature. And there's kind of hazing. There's all kinds of crazy stuff going on. So you have, I could just think of all kinds of situations where if you took those words literally, anybody could accuse anybody of sexual harassment. It's just so broad.
Probably so, yes, Andy. Probably so. But we have to understand that sexual harassment, there's a difference between sexual harassment and a sexual crime.
But a lot of these accusations are being portrayed more as sexual harassment as opposed to perhaps, I'm trying to not be insensitive to the victims, but the cases with Al Franken, the senator from
Minnesota.
Minnesota, thank you. They seem more along the lines of harassment than crime, perhaps. Doesn't that come down to a certain level of interpretation that if you tell some kind of joke, I might be offended by it, where typically it wouldn't be offensive, or, some other accusation is welcomed or not necessarily frowned upon. Like, for example, the first lady that came out to accuse Al Franken, I then found some videos where she was doing something kind of a similar nature. She like wrapped her leg around Robin Williams as she was introducing him on stage. Not to say that one cancels the other one, but it seems a little hypocritical for someone to go, hey, this guy did me wrong and I'm really pissed off about it. Oh, by the way, I'm going to go do it to someone else. Therefore, it's okay.
Well, sexual harassment could be criminal depending on how far it was taken, because you point out that making crude comments, telling someone they've got a nice rack,
right,
that's still used these days,
fine,
that's not criminal, but it's probably not something the average person would like to hear at work. And then telling someone that they've got a nice rack and that they'll get more hours if they let them squeeze that rack,
right?
Well, now that's a consensual act if the person consents to that behavior in exchange for more hours. But then we're getting closer and closer to a gray area, because the consent is received by some coercive offer that's
right,
made.
Right.
So then you might have a situation where a person of an adult nature we could say yes, that was valid consent. But if the person was a minor, if they were above the age of consent, but they were still a minor, that consent might not be as valid because of their age. So it's a very nuanced split of where sexual harassment crosses the line when someone says they consented to this act, but what happened in the intervening that caused them to consent is problematic. Well, apparently that was what's happened, alleged to have been happening with Matt Lauer. There's so many accusations, I can't keep them straight, but I think that there was some consensual stuff that people wish they hadn't have done. Do I have him confused?
I honestly haven't read very much. That one is still kind of new, and it's frankly, I'm getting a little numb to it all, just because it's like, oh my God, here's another one. It's overload to all that's going on after Harvey Weinstein and Roy Moore and Louis C.K. and on and on and on. I've just kind of stopped keeping track of it all because it's just so much. But just from the allegations of the one guy for Matt Lauer, like just a handful of allegations, and they fire the guy. They don't know whether the allegations are true or not. And it's really troublesome to me that they are, oh, hey, it's trendy now to take aggressive action against someone for just a claim. So somebody could just be accused of something, and the next thing you know, you got the SWAT team beating down your door arresting you for just an allegation.
Well, I think that what's happened, we have to roll back the clock a little bit to the confirmation hearings for Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas.
Okay.
And I can't tell you what year that was, but I'm thinking since it was George H.W. Bush, that would have been his presidency was 89 through January 93. So it was probably in the
early
1990 era.
Yep.
We have to roll back that, look at that era where we had a woman who had chief of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the former chief, who was Clarence Thomas, who had been nominated for the Supreme Court, that had been sought out. She didn't come forward, as I recall, voluntarily, but she'd been sought out because they were digging, looking for a reason not to confirm Thomas. And she said, yes, he was a creep and he did these things. He talked sexually inappropriate and talked about how well endowed he was. And it was just some stuff that just really was not very good. It was unbecoming of a Supreme Court justice. And so companies in the private sector and in the government sector, they adopted these sexual harassment policies in response to Anita Hill and what was revealed that was apparently tolerated. The companies have not been nearly as aggressive at enforcing those policies that they've had on their books all these years. And I think what we're seeing now is some backlash to the accusations that were made in mid-2016 against Donald Trump when he was a candidate, because he, by his own words, admitted that he had done some things that were sexually inappropriate and that he proclaimed that he was able to do that because of who he was with impunity. So I think now we're having people look at these policies that they've had, they have not been enforcing, and now it's become more important to enforce those policies. And I think we're getting an over-enforcement reaction now because, as you point out, with these people being terminated, they're being afforded very little due process. As far as we know, I don't know what due process Lauer got, but it seemed like it was minimal, if non-existent. Now, he was in a civil setting because his employment was a civil relationship that he had. But I think most of us listening to this podcast would hope that when we're going to lose our career and our livelihood, that there would be some modicum of due process provided where that they would be able to respond to the accusations and have some confrontation at some level with the accuser. And that appears not to be happening in a lot of these cases. It appears to be that the accusation is made and you're out.
Now that, I guess, in comparison to Bill O'Reilly, to where Fox was paying out settlements, if I'm not mistaken, and they were sheltering the guy for a very large number of years. So where that seems to have been squashing the issue, whereas the Lauer issue went the other extreme of, hey, we're not even going to entertain that this may be true. Take care. Granted, the guy was paid $20 million a year. It's not like he's on the food line. But if that were to happen to one of the regular folks, you know, you're on the unemployment line. And now when you go fill out the next job application and say, why did you leave the last job? Oh, well, I was accused of such and such. You're not going to get the next job.
That unfortunately is true. And we've learned through the years that accusations look at McMartin preschool, all those accusations that were made back in the 80s. People do make false accusations. Now, you and I in this broadcast, we're not able to determine anything about the validity of the accusations. So we're mainly talking about process.
Correct.
And the importance of due process and what this country stands for in the way of due process and presumption of innocence. Now, again, we're in a civil setting, but most people listening to this would believe that there should be some process provided. If you work in a company, that would allow you to be heard and to confront and have something, you need to know who's accusing you, what they're you of, and being given the opportunity to have some rebuttal. I don't see how all that took place in the very quick, expeditious way that Lauer was let go. I just don't see how there could have been any process provided whatsoever.
No, it happened in the matter of, like, there were accusations. I want to say it was over the weekend, and he was booted on a Monday or Tuesday.
So that's very troubling. There's a such thing as paid leave. There's a such thing as unpaid leave.
Yeah, Bill O'Reilly was put on like a month-long paid leave when all of his allegations started coming out.
So, well, in that regard, Fox was more respecting of due process than what happened in Lauer. That was NBC with Matt Lauer. Mm-hmm. And Fox was more respectful of due process.
And then, you know, you take the situation with the senators, Al Franken, Corker, is it?
I'm not familiar with any accusations against Corker from Tennessee.
No, maybe not Corker. He's 80 years old.
About the representative from Michigan. You're talking about the representative. That'd be Representative John Conyers.
Oh, see, started with a C. I was close. Yes, that guy. And so, you know, they're suggesting that they now resign. And up until recently, the Al Franken ones were all pre-Senate. And again, we still come back to maybe if those allegations had come out, would he not be elected? But are these guys supposed to step down? In my opinion, Al Franken, when I've watched the Senate confirmation hearings, he seems to be really thoughtful, comprehensive in his interrogations of the people that were being confirmed to the different cabinet positions. I'm not saying that one negates the other. If he's a scumbag, he's a scumbag and shouldn't be in the elite positions of our federal government. But again, you know, we have statute of limitations. How far back do you take this guy's history? And are we a nation of forgiveness? And can someone ever work past something that they may have done that was wrong?
Well, I believe that Senator Franken says he has a different recollection of what happened at the same event. So I would hope there again we would provide some due process for Senator Franken and even for would-be Senator Roy Moore. If the accusations are being made and he says it's not true, the Trump supporters believed him when he said, I really didn't say what I said. I said I didn't mean it. So I think that we would certainly give the same deference to people of slightly lower office holdings, that they would be some believability of what they say and some process provided for them for them to clear their name. I'm just troubled that people are supposed to have no process whatsoever.
I do find a great deal of irony in looking at the guy at the highest office who has admitted to doing the things, was accused by the people. We have tapes of him saying it. They still elect him. Then when there are new allegations to somebody on the other side, there's pitchforks and torches, and they want to throw the guy out. And same with Roy Moore, that they are perfectly willing to accept him into their camp because he has their same sort of politics philosophy.
I don't know if that's fair. There's been a significant number of Republicans that have called for him to withdraw from that race and have said that they will consider once he gets elected, and all indications are that he will be elected, whether or not they will seat him and under what circumstances they might, how they might seat him in terms of what limitations they may place on him. But I'm hopefully being as intellectually honest as possible. Both of them, which I would find myself much more agreeable to Franken's politics, both of them should be entitled to some process established that they committed these acts. And that's not being offered to either one of them. The presumption is if the accusation is there, it must be true. And I find that so troubling in America, where we're all about process. One of the things that makes this nation great is that we're a nation of laws, not of men. And we've got process in place, or so we claim.
Another thing that we discussed earlier was about the various standards. Like, you know, roughly, let's just say 100 years ago, it was okay for your grandmother and grandfather to be in their late teens, mid-teens, and get married and start having kids, whereas now the laws say that if you're less than 18, somebody's going to jail. So we have an evolving standard of what is acceptable as far as relationships go. And you and I were talking earlier about strict constitutionalists. And so on one hand, you would want to have an evolving standard. And on the other hand, there shouldn't be an evolving standard.
Well, there, unfortunately, what would or shouldn't be there, we have evolved as a society. And what was permissible at one point was not. But we can't go back and judge people's behavior through today's standards and punish them based on something that the standards tolerated at the time. That was the point I was making earlier. If we did that, a lot of the marriages that produced very fine children would be not acceptable by today's standard. And the same people that we allowed to get married that weren't old enough to get married under today's standards, they would have been subject to prosecution under today's standards. So we can't go back and change we can't do to Roy Moore if what he was, the behavior he was engaging in was acceptable at the time. And right. I don't know if it was or wasn't. Sexual assault has never been acceptable, even in those days. But if he was having consensual relationships with someone over the age of consent, we can't change that today and say, well, today that would be gross and unacceptable, because if it was acceptable at the time, that was the standards of the time.
Right. So we're perfectly happy to go back in and judge someone on today's standards based on what they were doing at the time, which was an acceptable standard, or, you know, at least not. What's the middle ground of saying no versus acceptable? There's some sort of middle ground term in there. Just, you know, like turn a blind eye to it, I guess, is one way to put it.
So and then there will be the strict constructionists. I think the question you were getting to is about interpretation of the Constitution. Is that where you were headed?
Yes, it is.
Well, the strict constructionists don't believe that there's an evolving standard of decency.
Correct.
So therefore, they believe that everything should be judged based on what words and what was acceptable at the time. So, for example, if you have a strict constructionist sitting on the court, they believe that the words are afforded the meaning that they had at the time, and they believe the standards of decency were those that existed at the time. So capital punishment, for example, was an acceptable behavior. It was an acceptable punishment at the time. It's become less acceptable as time has passed. But if you take a strict constructionist that looks at the Constitution from that era and what the framers would have been thinking, there's no way you conclude that capital punishment is cruel or unusual, because it was readily used at the time. It was accepted as a proper and appropriate punishment for certain crimes. So you would never get a finding that it constitutes cruel and unusual punishment.
Also along those lines is how the document is written to where it can be modified. And the only reason that you would be able to modify it is if something isn't covered by the other rules and other the way the wording is and the other amendments. So you have where the women's suffrage movement to allow them to vote happened. And then I think the most recent amendment was signed in the 70s, if I'm not mistaken.
Would that be the 18-year-olds the right to vote?
Fair. Sure.
I think it is the last amendment.
So there doesn't that inherently mean that it's designed to change over time?
It does mean that, in my opinion. It means that. It means that the founders recognized that the document might need to be modified as time passed. And they made it very difficult, but they did establish a process.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's not like you can just willy-nilly update stuff. 2/3 of the states have to ratify?
Actually, it's a higher number than that. It takes a 2/3 vote in both houses of the Congress, right. And then it has to be ratified by 3/4.
Okay, 3/4
of the state, states, which equals 38.
Okay.
So you've got to have super majorities in both houses of the Congress, and then you've got to have a significance.
Right.
So it's a difficult process, but they did recognize that the Constitution might need to be altered.
So, and I know that we're somewhat getting off course, but doesn't that mean that the idea is that it changes to reflect now?
I think that that would be one way of looking at it, that the founders realized that if the document survived, and there were some who had doubts that the country could survive, but if it did, that there would need to be change as times passed. And there has been a lot of change, things that the founders could never have foreseen.
Then why do people say that it should be interpreted based on the words of the time?
That's a philosophy that they hold, that the Constitution of the United States is such a beautiful document that it should be preserved at all costs in its original form, and that the founders were so brilliant that we should always look through their eyes and answer every question as if we were living in those times. They're convinced of that.
I need to talk to somebody on that side that can rationalize that argument, because if you can update the document with amendments, and we have done it 17 times since the original 10, and not like they were all done in the first 10 or 20 years of the founding of it, the last one was done in the 70s, just 30 or 40 years ago, then they intended the document to be updated based on current views.
That's certainly a rational explanation for the process that was established to change the Constitution.
But I'm struggling how you get to the point.
People believe that.
I'm baffled. I'm just baffled.
I've done presentations before where I give an example that the founders, but it has evolved through the time. And I get a kick because I watched an interview by the late Justice Antonin Scalia talking about statutory words. He believed that you should look at the black letters as they were written, and you should read nothing more into the statute, nothing to do with intent. So he picked the example that I'm using. He picked a statute that says that the prevailing party shall be awarded attorney's fees. Well, as you look at that attorney's fees, what does that mean? Well, to an originalist and to a strict constructionist, that means the fee for the attorney.
Okay.
But for someone that's a little bit more, takes a broader view, the writers of that statute meant to make the prevailing party whole rather than the fees for the attorney. So a prevailing party would be awarded the fees for the attorney plus the cost of the deposition, the filing, the printing fees,
expert witnesses,
the expert witnesses fees, and a whole lots of other stuff. And Scalia said, nope, that's not exactly. He said, I am not here to make law. The Fair. Statute says that the winning party gets attorney's fees. So when I look at your fee petition, I will give you your fees. And if you've got a problem with that, you can go back to the legislature and tell them. They certainly know how to craft additional language and give the authority that they want to go beyond attorney's fees. But attorney's fees means attorney's fees. So how does he come up with that? Well, he says, I look at just the letters and the words and give them their ordinary meaning, and you get your attorney's fees. Who's right?
I kind of have a hard time arguing with his point, though.
Well, clearly the intent of the law was to make the losing party whole.
Are you sure?
I mean, the winning party, though. The winning party whole. Because you've had to go to court. You've had to litigate your claims. And due to the complexities of modern-day litigation, you have a lot of cost that when the statute was written all these decades ago, didn't exist. Forensics has evolved in the last 30 years where if you went in a courtroom 30 years ago, you wouldn't have seen flip charts and expert witnesses, and you wouldn't have seen all the stuff you see today that's common day in litigation. So the statute has not been updated to reflect the changes.
And,
but the intent was there.
Right. And then it is an escalation that one side would bring in a piece of the puzzle and then the other side doesn't. So then they lose. Well, on the next case, then they have to bring in, you know, it's just a constant escalation up to nuclear warfare of who can bring in the better whiz-bang information that costs ever increasing amounts of dollars for you to win a case. So now you're buying your victory to a certain degree versus winning it based on the merits of the case.
That is correct. And that's unfortunately the when we get back to our original point of these cases, these accusations, and in many cases, there won't be any evidence. But in the cases where there happened to have been some evidence preserved, then it's a very expensive process. And you start battling the experts if there happened to have been any forensics evidence that has been preserved through these years. If the case is set on the shelf since 1982, and there happened to have been a collection of a rape kit and happened to have been a collection of clothing and things that were beyond the technology at the time, but now they're not, then the party that has the accusation made against them has to employ experts to counter the government's experts, because the police will have ample experts in most cases. They'll have the best laboratories, they'll have best witness, and they'll have an opinion about what that evidence means. And the person 30 years ago may or may not have done something has to match that, or at least respond to that if they have any hope of a fair trial. And our country's not very generous about giving equals who have limited resources so that they can match the government.
Right. I don't know what else to do with this one, Larry. I'm very conflicted on it. I don't have anything else to cover on the subject either.
Well, I'm very conflicted as well, because my fear is that we're going to make emotional decisions in our state legislature based on what's really a media frenzy now.
Yeah.
And we're gonna make emotional decisions to completely jettison and extinguish the statute of limitation. And we're going to have a lot of prosecution. And it's going to be kind of the reverse of who was it that said it was better for 100 to go free than an innocent, than one innocent to be convicted?
I know the
was
expression.
Was that Thomas Jefferson?
I don't know the expression, but yeah, I know of it. Let's look it up. Well, keep talking.
Well, we're going to have the reverse of that. We're going to have potentially people. With all these accusations, clearly some of them were true. Some of them in various facets, that there was something that happened. And so we've got some people that are responsible for some bad behavior. But I can't believe that every single one is completely true to the T, that there's been no exaggeration, no faulty memory. So we're going to have the reverse of it. We're going to have people being convicted or being railroaded to plead guilty to something that they didn't do. And I can give you an example of something that the power of the government, former general, I think he's retired, Michael Flynn. You're familiar with that name?
I am familiar with Michael Flynn.
Yeah, well, a general draws a pretty good salary. Would you agree?
Yeah, it's around 100 grand, I'm sure. And then there are perks.
Yeah, greater than 100 grand. But the conservative talking heads were saying when he copped his plea, when he agreed to plead guilty, that's an example of the power of the government and how they can break anybody, and he's a broken man.
Yes.
Well, I actually agree with that the government, be it state or federal, they do have enormous power and they can break almost anybody. But we can't pick and choose on our side about who, if we believe that the government can break anybody and compel them to plead guilty, someone as strong as a three-star, four-star, I believe it's four-star general. Mm-hmm. If they can do that to a four-star general, what can they do to an average, ordinary person who doesn't have a six-figure retirement, who doesn't have friends in high places, who can't get very good legal counsel? If they can cajole him to plead guilty and he's really not guilty by threatening his family, wouldn't they be able to do the same thing to just an average citizen?
You would think that they would be able to do it in spades.
So we're gonna have a rush of criminal prosecution, some of them of dubious nature, and I'm fearful that we're gonna have a lot more people that are not guilty, or at least not as guilty of what they're being accused of, that won't feel like they can defend themselves because of the media feeding frenzy that's surrounding these cases. So it's a terrible tragedy for those who have been victimized and haven't had any justice of any kind. And it's a terrible tragedy for those who are accused and convicted wrong and haven't done these things, or at least they haven't done. If you've been accused of 10 crimes and you did one crime, it's not fair for you to be convicted of 10.
Right. Just to circle back, the Benjamin Franklin quote is that it is better 100 guilty persons should escape than one innocent person should suffer. That is the Benjamin Franklin quote.
I was thinking it was Franklin, and I see that my fear is that we're going to have the reverse of that, that we're going to be willing to have collateral damage of convicting some innocent people just so we get some culprits. And I don't want the culprits out there either, but too much time has passed in most of these cases for these people to get anything that resembles a fair trial.
Right.
And we are a nation where we believe fairness is a part of our system, I thought.
That was the idea. I thought that you were innocent until proven guilty, and an allegation isn't proven guilty.
And a fair trial.
Right.
It's an integral part of our system. You're supposed to be tried by a jury of your peers, and it's supposed to be fair, and it's supposed to be timely. And timely is not 20, 30, 40 years later.
But is that on the defendant to determine the timeline, or is that, which goes to the statute of limitations, that the victim is supposed to come out and accuse you of the thing within some sort of reasonable time, and then you have that right to a speedy trial, so you're not just sitting there in limbo for forever waiting for the government to... But, you know, isn't that into itself, isn't that sort of subjective? What does a speedy trial actually mean?
It varies. There's a Supreme Court precedent, and it varies according to the complexity of the case. But a speedy trial, that is something that's triggered after a prosecution has commenced. So it's separate from the statute of limitations. So,
right.
So once the government has brought its resources to charge you with a crime, then you have a right to a reasonably quick trial, and the complexity of the trial determines how what is considered reasonable. A very complicated trial where the issues are significant, the speedy trial would be less speedy than if you were charged with a low-level misdemeanor.
Right. And so we were doing some research, and you found a motion in Georgia with, I want to say, is it Brian Nichols, where it appeared as though the judge was just letting the guy sit for somewhat of an indeterminate amount of time, and his attorney filed a motion saying that his rights were being violated by just dragging him?
I do recall that. I haven't read it with precision, but yes, I do recall that.
But so it just, and maybe I'm conflating multiple things, but that's what we're going after here, is like he's sitting in jail. He has been charged, formally charged with the thing, but instead of actually bringing him to trial, he's just sitting there rotting in jail. And his attorney filed some sort of motion saying that his constitutional rights were being violated that he wasn't getting his right to a speedy trial that way.
That is correct. And that frequently happens when a person is in custody, the state is typically happy because short of the death penalty, which is rarely imposed, being in custody is about as good as it gets for the government, for the state or whoever's seeking that person's incarceration. So speedy trial is not something they're concerned about because theoretically they could lose the trial. So if they've got you in custody and that you're either on no bond or excessively high bond, which is a topic for another conversation about American bail bond system. But if you're being forced to post a very high amount of money to be released from jail, they're happy with you sitting in custody because your punishment has already commenced. Anybody who's been in jail, I don't think anybody can tell me that I'm aware of that there's any differentiation between how they treat a person who's pre-trial versus post-trial. When you're in jail awaiting trial, you still get strip searched. You still have limitations of monitoring on your phone. Right. You still eat the same food. You still are subject to random strip searches throughout the day and ransacking of your property. You're limited on what you can visit your family members to usually over a video conference of some type. Your correspondence is censored. I mean, it's as if you've been convicted. They don't have a special wing in the jail where they say, oh, well, you're pre-trial, so we've got nice, cushy beds for you, and we're going to make sure that you have access to the prison law library, and we're going to make sure that you can have full access to the telephone, to the internet, so you can mount a successful defense. I'm not aware of any correctional facilities that take that approach. Are you?
No, they don't. You were treated there with general population.
Yeah, so for all practical purposes, the government has used its objective when you're in custody pre-trial.
Yeah, you might actually have more permissions once you actually make it through the system.
As if you'd been convicted.
Yeah, well, that might be a subject for one day about how they treat you just in that custody phase, too, while you're waiting. You know, it's part of the bond system, part of pre-trial and all that stuff while you're still in custody. Where Paul Manafort was held in house arrest and he put up $14 million in property, $4 million in property. I remember a four in there for him to get off a house arrest. And that's Paul Manafort.
I think that was over the top. And first of all, I don't think that was necessary in his case. I'm not a Manafort fan, but it's an excessive amount of money for a person who has the limited ability to disappear. I mean, where would he hide? But that made people feel good to put that requirement on him. But it wasn't necessary to assure his appearance. That's what conditions of release were supposed to do, is reasonably assure the person's participation and appearance in the proceedings. And you didn't need to do that to Paul Manafort.
And okay, so here's another. Here's another side story. So in today's world, as a matter of fact, there was a contest on Wired magazine. This is 2012, 2013. Some journalist would go completely off grid and only communicate at a very sporadic interval and try and be as covert as possible. And the contest was, can his location be tracked? And the hackers got together and they tracked him down. So I use that just as like the storyline behind, can someone literally hide and vanish off the face of the earth to where the government, with all of its means and powers, couldn't track somebody down?
Well, I'm not as sophisticated technologically as some, but it's increasingly difficult because of the various databases and the inability to go off grid altogether, because everything you do connects you to something. You'd have to operate entirely in cash. You'd have to figure out some way to travel where none of your documents were scanned into systems that would track you. You'd have to figure out some way to disassociate from everybody who's ever known you that you might want to talk to.
And the example of that is, the real world example of that is Edward Snowden, and you go flee to a hostile nation, to the United States, so they don't extradite you.
Yeah, because, well, of course, we know where he is, but it would be very difficult to go incognito in the modern era. We don't live in the world the way it once was. I mean, you could conceivably disappear to a place like Somalia, but who would want to go there?
I was going to say, do you want to be? I've often said, as far as traveling, you can't go to the places you would want to go, but you can sure go to the places you would not want to go.
But even in a place like Somalia, there's enough technology that, with the vast resources the U.S. government has, that if they had good reason to believe that you had made it to Somalia, they could still track you there. And they would go in the middle of the night, if they wanted you bad enough, and drag you out without going through a formal extradition process. And once you're back on U.S. soil, it does not matter how you got here.
Yeah, sure.
Whether legal or illegal means were employed is not relevant.
Yeah, sure. Oh, boy. Another one of those issues, Larry, where I don't necessarily feel better when we're done.
So, well, I hope it's been helpful to the listeners that
absolutely.
We have a real, real potential crisis and overreaction happening. And trying to strike that critical balance is going to be important. And I'm afraid that the frenzied pitch that everything is, we won't strike that critical balance. And I'm afraid that we're going to go way too far.
And again, I do want to say that we are not trying to be insensitive to the victims, the accusers, just that we're you got to draw that balance, like you just said.
So, well, it's my pleasure as always being with you on this podcast. I'm looking forward to the next one.
Thank you so much, Larry. Have a great night. I'll talk to you soon.
Good night.
Bye. Have a question?